Without strong positive emotion, no spiritual progress is possible. I'd even put it as strongly as that. We are not kept going by abstract ideas. We are kept going by our emotions. It is our positive emotions which keep us going on the spiritual path, which give us inspiration, enthusiasm, and so on. Until such time as we can develop perfect wisdom and be motivated by that. So that's Bhante Sangharakshita talking about the importance of positive emotion. He couldn't, in a way, put it more strongly than that. Without strong positive emotion, no spiritual progress is possible. I'd even put it as strongly as that, he says. And Bhante is very careful with his words. He doesn't use words lightly. So I take that very seriously. I take it very seriously in my own spiritual endeavours. And I think collectively in our movement, we all take it very seriously, this importance of positive emotion. And I was thinking today, as I was writing this talk, how, in a way, the world needs to take it more seriously. How there's an urgent need for more positive emotion in the world. As I was writing this talk, I was writing it this afternoon, finishing it off this afternoon, and I distracted myself by looking at the Guardian website and learned that there'd been an explosion. A terrorist bomb had exploded in a suicide bomb in Moscow airport, in the largest airport in Moscow, where over 30 people have died and I think over 130 people injured. And in a way, that's not even just an isolated incident in our world, is it? In a way, it will have, it makes the headlines today, it might be in the headlines tomorrow, by next week we'll have moved on. And yeah, the world really needs positive emotion. Really, really needs positive emotion. I've entitled my talk of Gods and Men because I went to see the film of Gods and Men a few weeks ago. I don't know, some of you are nodding and have seen it. It's a very, very beautiful film and I really, really would recommend it. And I want to sort of refer to it because I was very struck by the ideals that were held and beautifully depicted in the film of a group of, eight French Cistercian monks in the 90s, so it's based on fact, in the mid-90s, living in a monastery in Algeria, an Islamic country, in a village in the Atlas Mountains. And the village had grown up around the monastery. And it doesn't say how long the monastery had been there, but there'd been at least a generation of people who had lived with the monastery, a generation of Muslims that had grown up around this Catholic Cistercian monastery. And the film just, in a way, is a very slow meditative depiction of monastic life as lived by these eight men. And apparently the Cistercian tradition is very much emphasises self-sufficiency and work, as well as contemplation. And the film really depicts this, and it depicts it both in its content and in the way that it's made. It's a beautifully contemplative film. But it's also a gripping film. It's a gripping film because the monks are in the midst of a dilemma. There's danger all around in the country that they're in. In Algeria, in the 90s, there's civil war breaking out. And there's increasing threat from terrorism, from Islamist factions that are terrorising their own population and terrorising any foreigners in the country. And the army are advising the monks to flee while they can. They're advising the monks to flee because they feel they're not going to be able to continue to protect them if they stay. the villagers are pleading with the monks to stay, because the monks have this delightful relationship with the villagers. There's a doctor amongst the monks, and he's the only doctor in the village. And he runs a clinic. He runs a clinic to, in a way, dispense medicine, but also he seems to dispense shoes. They come to him for shoes. The villagers come for shoes and advice, even about their love life. To these monks. So there's this real kind of paternal presence over the village. And the villagers are saying, if you leave, we're nothing without you. So the monks are in a real dilemma. In a real dilemma. And the film is about this dilemma and how it plays out in their interactions with each other, in their own hearts, in their interactions with the villagers, the army, and indeed with these Islamist terrorists. I'm going to come back to that film later on, of Gods and Men. But positive emotion. So what is positive emotion? According to the Buddhist tradition, what is positive emotion? Well, I'm not going to say very much, apart from to say that its foundation is metta. It's metta. It's also other positive states that in a way derive from metta. So normally at a night we've got Dharma night, and so Bhadramati and Jayaka are exploring, they have been exploring for the last 2 weeks and are going to continue exploring over the next few weeks, a set of meditation practices, a set of mental states called the Brahmaviharas, and metta is one of those. And you've also got sympathetic joy, compassion and equanimity. And also amongst positive emotion is shraddha, is faith and devotion. And some of those I'll come back to. Metta and shraddha I'll particularly come back to. But when Bhante puts it as strongly as he does about the need and the importance of positive emotion, one of the things that arises for me, and it might have arisen for you, is, well, what about negative emotion? Because I'm not always in a positive state. What about negative emotion? Does it mean that I can't live the spiritual life because I'm not always in a positive state? And I think in a way the question's got an obvious answer, but I think it's worth engaging with what do we do with our less positive emotions, with the emotions that aren't helpful in the spiritual life, or they don't move us in the direction of enlightenment. Because in a way, positive emotion, you could term that helpful emotion, helpful, skillful emotion, in the sense that it moves us in the direction of growth, in the direction of truth, in the direction of the Buddhas. So what about the emotions that don't? And those emotions, in a way, can be grouped, can't they, very broadly under the headings of craving and hatred. What about our craving and hatred? What do we do with that? Well, last year was the year of integration. And integration, I think, is somehow the key to what we need to do with our less than positive emotions. We do need to acknowledge them. We need to actually even be able to feel them. We need to take responsibility for them without indulging them, without acting out of them, or as best we can. If we do act out of them, then we need to be able to apologise, to confess, to make amends. So, the first thing I guess I want to say is that we don't have to be perfect in order to live the spiritual life. Ratna Ghosha, who used to be chair here when I first came along here, once said in a talk something that I was really, really struck with and has stayed with me. He said that in his meetings with people in the Sangha, he kept coming across two common obstacles that seemed to hold people back from making progress in the spiritual life. And he said the first obstacle was people thinking that they had to be perfect. And he said the second obstacle was people thinking that other people had to be perfect. And neither of those is Fortunately, neither of those is necessary, because we wouldn't be going very far if that was necessary. So we don't have to be perfect. And in this film of Gods and Men, these monks are not perfect. One of the beauties of the film is that the humanity of each of the individuals is depicted. So, for example, they quarrel. They have doubts. They have doubts about their own faith. They have doubts about the wisdom of staying. They have doubts about whether they can go. And it's not always out of altruism that they've got the doubts. They're not sure if they did leave, if they left this monastery in the Atlas Mountains, where would they go to? What would they do? This has been their whole life. So you get this real kind of human tension being played out, which I kind of resonated with. The second thing under this heading of what do we do with our negative emotions, in a way, I just want to re-emphasise something that probably all of you know, but I think I keep feeling I need to be reminded of, which is that we don't need to be happy in order to cultivate or develop or dwell in positive emotion. We don't need to be happy. Metta is not the same as happiness. And what's more, happiness isn't the same as pleasure. Happiness isn't the same as pleasure. I wish I could have that tattooed on my forehead, but happiness is not the same as pleasure. I wouldn't do much good on the forehead, in a way. I need to remember that, because I so habitually confuse happiness with pleasure, and it doesn't work. The worldly-minded person thinks in terms of happiness. The spiritually-minded person thinks in terms of liberation. So that's Bhante again. Our emotions, our positive emotions, are those that are going to lead us towards liberation. Happiness might be a fortunate byproduct. I've also been reading a little book of interviews with Aung San Suu Kyi, who, as you know, has just been freed from house arrest. She spent the best part of, I think, probably around 15 out of the last 20 years under house arrest in Burma. This book of interviews, I think, was... these interviews must have been recorded when she was last free. I don't know how long ago that was, but when she was last free. And what strikes you reading these, and also when I've seen clips of her on the news, what strikes you is her emotional positivity. I mean, she's got a tremendous resilience and courage and other things, but it just seems, this positivity seems to radiate from her with a sort of naturalness that's really inspiring. And she's remarking in this book, just in a very, very casual way, that she does regret that she wasn't able to see her children grow up. And that's quite something, isn't it, to remark on that. She doesn't even remark on the fact that her husband died while she was under house arrest, and in the last, I don't know, 5-6 years of his life, they weren't able to meet. He had cancer. He was in Oxford, an academic in Oxford, a Tibetologist in Oxford, and she felt that if she did leave the country, which she would have been allowed to do, she wouldn't have been allowed back in. And her response has been, when she says this, oh yes, I do regret not seeing my children grow up, she then says, but I'm really, really fortunate because I feel a duty towards my country and I'm living a really fulfilling life out of that sense of duty to my country. And she said, besides, you can't have everything in life. You can't have everything. And she said, it's only the immature and the young that feel that they can. Really kind of just pragmatic, no-nonsense attitude. And then she says, actually, that house arrest isn't such a hardship. Many, many people suffer much more. She was in her own house. And the interviewer says, he reminds us that actually at times she ran out of food. She was so malnourished that her hair was falling out. She had to try and sell her furniture, her family, etc., etc. So it can't have been easy. I mean, I think about the longest time I spent alone, and it's on solitary retreat, probably, and it was, my longest solitary retreat was 4 weeks, and that was in Mallorca. And the greatest danger I faced was, well, that the ice cream might run out or something. So it's very, very inspiring to see a Buddhist, a living Buddhist practitioner, in a way living from metta, and really not confusing happiness and pleasure with metta. And Bhante said that we can't always be happy, we can't always be happy, but we can always be friendly, or at least we can always potentially be friendly, if you see what I mean. So I'm really struck by that, and in a way want to remind myself and all of us of that. And lastly, under this heading of negative emotions, I just want to say that we need to learn to feel them, and we need to think in terms of transformation, not in terms of denying that we do get into states of hatred and craving. Bhante says, it is better to establish real, living contact with negative emotions, which means acknowledging and experiencing them, but not indulging them, rather than to remain in that alienated state and not experience our emotions at all. Yeah. So for some of us, when we come across the spiritual life, I think I count myself as one of these people, I had to learn to just experience my emotions more fully at all. And when I started doing the Metta Bhavana, before I started, I thought I was quite a nice man. The more I did the Metta Bhavana, the more I thought, my God, you're angry. And, I had to kind of learn to, in a way, acknowledge that. And, I'm still learning. Okay, so that's a little bit about negative emotion. And what do we do? In a way, as I say, we need to integrate them. Last year was the year of integration, so it's a bit late. No, but you can't leave behind integration. That's the point I wanted to make. You can't leave behind integration. These great stages of the path, integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, and compassion activity, they're not just sort of sequential, linear stages that can be cut and dry, separated from each other. As in so many models from the Dharma, they're much more subtle than that. These stages unfold out of each other, but they also contain each other, and you can't leave anything behind. So integration is really important. So in the rest of my talk, I want to talk under three headings. I want to say something about strengthening the foundation for positive emotions to arise. How do we do that? Secondly, I'm going to talk about having the courage to act from our positive emotions. And then lastly, I'm going to talk about going beyond positive emotion. So, the second section of my talk, strengthening the foundation of our positive emotions, strengthening the foundations that enable positive emotions to arise. An essential aspect of this foundation, perhaps the essential aspect of this foundation, is ethics, is the five precepts that we've just chanted, is our actual behaviour, our volitional behaviour, our volitional impulses. Without a foundation in ethics, positive emotion doesn't really stand a chance. Yes, we might have moments of kindness, spontaneous feelings of compassion, generosity, etc. But if we're going to systematically transform the greed, the hatred, the delusion that lies within all of us, then we need a stronger foundation than chance and circumstance, and we need ethics. We need to build our lives on these five precepts. So from a dharmic perspective, our consciousness arises moment to moment. It arises afresh every moment. But it's influenced, it's conditioned by the past. In particular, it's conditioned by our volitional impulses from our past actions, our volitional impulses from the past. Those volitions influence the quality and the state of consciousness that arises moment to moment. So in the moment, our task is to, in a way, act in a way that will cause the future consciousness to arise in a way that's more expansive, more free, more positive, more skillful, more radiant, more connected, more aware. So this is, of course, the law of karma, the karma niyama, the law of karma. And I haven't got time to go into ethics in any detail, or indeed karma in any detail. But I just want to sort of say two or three things about the precepts. The first thing is that we, of course, recite these precepts in their negative form and their positive form. And both are important. Both are important. In their negative form, I think for me they mean, they point to a sort of standard of behaviour below which I do not want to allow myself to fall. A standard of behaviour below which I do not want to allow myself to fall. And hopefully all serious practitioners wouldn't fall below that standard of behaviour in their negative form. And one thing that I just want to point out is the taking of life. And most of us will hopefully never take life, at least not in a deliberate way. But I do want to point out the importance of vegetarianism, where indirectly, if we're not vegetarian, then we are taking life. And I think any serious Buddhist practitioner ought to be taking that really, really seriously. I think if we're really practicing the metta bhavana, and you want to know whether it's working, then you could ask yourself, where do I stand on vegetarianism? Where do I stand on vegetarianism? And I don't think it's just a rule that we should be following. I think that it's a quality of emotion, a quality of empathy, a quality of sensitivity, of ethical sensibility that we're trying to cultivate. And that is the test. In a certain sense, I think we should be revolted by the notion of it should cause this sort of physical revulsion in us. And if it doesn't, well, then think about our practice of the metta bhavana. Perhaps we need to do more of it. Perhaps that's all I'll say about the negative precepts. In the positive precepts, I just wanted to, first of all, say that all the positive precepts, all the precepts, in a way, spring from metta, don't they? They spring from metta. Metta is the foundation for all the precepts. But I particularly want to talk about generosity. I particularly want to talk about generosity as a sort of basic Buddhist virtue. That's how Bhante refers to it, as a basic Buddhist virtue. Sometimes it's not very easy, despite what Bhante says, to feel kind or even friendly. But we can always try and be generous. And it doesn't have to be in a big way. Generosity can just be a small act of awareness and empathy and action towards another person, seeing what they need rather than what I need. So generosity, the word is dana. And again, I was recently with Ratna Ghosha on a chairs meeting. And he's a great, great lover of dana, of generosity. In a way, it's a sort of cornerstone of his practice. And he was saying he would really like to see in our movement a culture of dana, a culture of dana. And it's not that we don't have a culture of dana. At the LBC, I think we have got a culture of generosity. Broadly speaking, in the Sangha, there's a lot of generosity, awareness, and kindness. I live in a community upstairs with eight or nine other guys, and there's a real spirit of generosity that flows, and it really is a delight to be part of that sort of field of generosity. So I don't think we're doing badly, and I know that that's not alone. That's not an isolated kind of condition in our Sangha. And I think there's always further to go. I always think there's further to go. And dana is one of those virtues where there's no limit. I also think that it's easy particularly in our consumer culture, perhaps particularly in London, for us to start to take even the Dharma for granted, even the Buddhist centre for granted. We can start to feel as if it's somehow just another thing that we can turn up to and consume, and there'll always be somebody here leading the meditations, ringing the bells, offering Dharma teaching, etc., etc. Partly, I think that's a function of size. If we were a tiny centre with maybe just one order member leading activities, I was talking to Dana Priya, who's leading activities in Deal. Until recently, all the activities happened from his bedroom and his lounge, probably. And people were incredibly generous because they could see that it was him giving. Here, the LBC, it's also run on the basis of generosity, on the basis of Dana. But it can look like we're a big institution that somehow got government funding. Well, we don't. Yeah, we don't. The centre operates on generosity. But the last thing I want to say about generosity is that we need to give. I mean, what I mean is we need to give regardless of the cause, or if you see what I mean. We need to learn to become more generous. I need to learn to give for my own spiritual welfare, because I am trying to overcome my self-centeredness, my self-cherishing. And the self-centeredness and the self-cherishing goes surprisingly deep. It goes very, very deep. And so I need to learn to be more generous if I'm going to make progress in the direction of enlightenment. Yeah, in this film of Gods and Men, you really see these monks exemplifying generosity. And it's perhaps all the more moving because it's across religions and across cultures. There's this real sense of generosity building relationships. That's what it does. It builds sangha. Aung San Suu Kyi says, if you're feeling helpless, help someone. If you're feeling helpless, help someone. And elsewhere she says, saying how, well, Burma's a Buddhist country, but many, many people don't actually take Buddhism very seriously. They take it for granted. And because they're born into a Buddhist culture, they kind of assume that they're Buddhist, but they feel that they don't have to practice. And the interviewer asks her, well, what would make a real, real difference to your country, this country? And she said, if everybody lived by the five precepts, we'd be home and dry. We'd be home and dry. Okay, so I'm going to move on. So I now want to look at acting from positive emotion. So ethics, those precepts, are the foundation of positive emotion. If we act from ethics, positive emotion will unfold. It will arise. It will arise naturally. But then we need to act from it. Positive emotion is something that we do. It's action. It's karma. In a way, it's an odd thing to be giving a talk about because it's not something that you talk about particularly. You embody and you act. It's always specific, for example. Metta isn't an abstract idea. It's specific in the moment, in the instance. You meet somebody and you take them in with awareness, and you respond out of that awareness and empathy, or as much awareness and empathy as you can. And then, in a way, the response becomes clear, but you can't plan it in advance. It's not an abstract thing. Love is no flabby sentiment, but a vigorous expression of an imaginative identification with other living beings. That's Bhante again, in the Ten Pillars. Love is no flabby sentiment, but a vigorous expression of an imaginative identification with other living beings. It takes energy. It takes energy. The stage of positive emotion is also the stage of energy. It's the stage of what's called prayoga, of energetic effort, because it takes effort to go beyond our self-cherishing. Self-cherishing comes easily to most of us. It comes all too easily. And it takes real energy to counteract that. And positive emotion should make a positive difference. It should make a positive difference to people around us, to others, to the lives of others around us. It should make a positive difference to others in the Sangha, and it should make a positive difference to others who are outside the Sangha around us. This year, the year of positive emotion, I'd really, really like to see us come up with initiatives. I haven't got the answers, but I'd really like us to come up with initiatives, individually and collectively, to take positive emotion not just into the Sangha, which I do want, but outside of the Sangha, outside of the walls, as it like, of the mandala, outside of this beautiful mandala that we've created. There's a whole world out there and a lot of people in need of positive emotion. And as Buddhists, we shouldn't be restricting ourselves to, in a way, the relative comfortableness of living and working within the Sangha. So I'd really encourage us individually and in whatever groups you find yourself in the Sangha, whether that's a Mitra group, a GFR group, a chapter, a class team, a community, with friends, I'd really encourage us to think about how we, as groups perhaps, could take initiatives to make a difference, at least in Bethnal Green, if not in London. To go beyond 51 Roman Road and its, half square mile radius. Yes, acting from positive emotion. And that action requires courage, particularly if we want to go out to people who might not hold the values and the ideals that we hold. It requires courage. Metta requires courage. Some of you who have been on the winter retreat, and I was at the reunion yesterday, and we were talking, I was talking to some people, and there was this acknowledgement that it's difficult to go back into, after a retreat, go back into our ordinary lives, our relationships, our families, our work colleagues, because those people haven't been on retreat and probably don't know what it means to be on retreat, don't know what it is to meditate, don't know what it is to be opening up to ideals that take us beyond ourselves. And it is difficult. It is difficult, but metta shouldn't be confused with weakness. It's actually, metta should make us more robust. It should make us more robust because we have inner resources that allow us to face the challenges in a way that people who don't meditate perhaps don't have. They perhaps don't have those resources within them, or they don't perhaps have such easy access to them. So we should be, in a way, becoming gradually more robust. And that's not easy, it takes courage. It takes courage to stand against the group. Buddhism in this country has a fairly good press, doesn't it? And mostly, when you say to people, you're a Buddhist, at least in my experience, I've just met with relatively positive, perhaps neutral, but never really particularly difficult responses, bar one or two occasions. But nevertheless, if you start acting from your values, you will have to stand out. You will have to stand out. And I think as Buddhists, we ought to be standing out. We ought to be standing out because we ought to be a bit different. Even if you don't tell somebody you're a Buddhist, if you're seriously practicing, sincerely practicing, there ought to be something in your responses that is a bit different. We shouldn't fit in. It is often said that one should have the courage of one's convictions. Perhaps one should also have the courage of one's positive emotions. That's Bhante in an aphorism again. Perhaps one should also have the courage of one's positive emotions. Because if you feel kindly, and if you feel generous, and if you feel empathy, then in a way there's a responsibility, almost a compulsion, to live from that, to live from them. In the film of Gods and Men, you really see them doing this and struggling with this. There's this scene where they're in their chapel, and there's this army helicopter, and it's the army helicopter. The army is sort of should be protecting them, but it's this army helicopter that roams around outside trying to intimidate them. Trying to intimidate them because the army want them to leave because they don't want the responsibility of looking after these monks. And this helicopter, you just hear this sound, this whirring sound of this helicopter, and these eight men sort of, in a way, just trapped in a way and sort of defenceless in this chapel. And what they do is they start chanting. They start chanting. And they sort of build up this chant, very beautiful sort of Gregorian chanting. And the sort of camera just pans back, and you can still hear this chanting, and you can hear this helicopter. And it's as if the chanting becomes gradually more dominant, and the helicopter flies off. And it's just a little image. It's a symbolic image of the power of positive emotion, if you have the courage of it. If you have the courage of it. It's very beautiful. And so that courage doesn't mean that we won't feel fear. It doesn't mean that we won't feel fear. And if we didn't feel fear, there would be no need for courage. Courage isn't the same as fearlessness. Fearlessness may be a gift, but perhaps more precious is the courage acquired through endeavour. Courage that comes from cultivating the habit of refusing to let fear dictate one's actions. Courage that could be described as grace under pressure. Grace which is renewed repeatedly in the face of harsh, unremitting pressure. And that's Bhante again. There's again, I was reading an incident from Aung San Suu Kyi's life, and it's one of several incidents like this that she describes, but it's just one that sort of stayed in my mind. And she said that she and a group of her party friends were walking down the road, coming home from some meeting, and they were also being accompanied by a major from the army. He was offering them protection. And in the head of the party, as it were, the person walking in front was a young student carrying their flag. And they were walking down the road, in the middle of the road, just a few of them. And suddenly, in front of them, these group of soldiers appear with guns trained on them. And the officer in charge shouts at them, telling them to get off the road. And the major and the officer, the major's protecting them, the officer, you know, is holding a rifle pointed at them, and they start having an argument, as it were. And Aung San Suu Kyi says, what is going on? And the officer was saying, you're not going to walk in the centre of the road. You cannot walk in the centre of the road. So Aung San Suu Kyi says, great, okay, we'll split into two and we'll walk down the sides of the road. She wanted no confrontation. She wanted to, but she did want to carry on walking. And the officer says, no, if you walk down the sides of the road, we'll also shoot at you. And she says, at this point, I thought this was silly. this wasn't reasonable, she says, because were we going to walk, you know, if we can't walk in the centre, if we can't walk inside, where am I going to walk? And then she says, well, if he's going to behave unreasonably, I will walk in the centre. And what she does is she goes to the front of the group because she says she wanted to protect the student, and she kind of figured that if there was a target, it was her, and she didn't want this young man to be shot. And she just walks down the centre of this road with rifles trained on her, and the people in her party walk behind her. And as she passes these gunmen, these soldiers who are kneeling on the ground with their rifles, she says she noticed some of them were trembling, shaking. And she said she didn't know whether they were shaking from nerves or fear or whatever it was, but she said, I wasn't concerned because I'd already gone past by then. And that's just amazing, isn't it? Well, she says the only real prison is fear. This is a woman who spent 15 years under house arrest. The only real prison is fear, and the only real freedom is freedom from fear. So yes, the courage of our positive emotions. In comparison to that, I've never, and hopefully will never have to, and none of us will hopefully ever have to, face that sort of fear. I don't know whether I'd be able to rise to that sort of courage. But in comparison, the challenges that face me in my everyday life are small. They're small. Okay, so I want to move on to my last section of the talk, going beyond positive emotion. So this is Banti again. When out of meta, you see things as beautiful, you naturally experience joy and delight. And out of that joy and delight flow spontaneity, freedom, creativity, and energy. Out of that joy and delight flow spontaneity, freedom, creativity, and energy. It's like positive emotion metta opens the door to all of these qualities that start flowing in us and through us. In the film of Gods and Men, there's this scene, and I know I'm giving away things, but do go and see it. If I didn't give away things, I couldn't illustrate it, could I? There's this scene. The film's very subdued in its emotionality. It's very spare. There's not, you know, the monks are. What's the word? They don't. They're not very expressive of their emotions throughout the whole film. It's quite matter of fact. Beautiful, but matter of fact. Spare, like I imagine a Zen monastery might be. Then there's this scene where, well, they've decided to stay. All eight of them have decided to stay. And each of them has individually decided that. Yeah, they went round, and each of them was free to leave, and each of them decided to stay for various reasons. And they gathered round for supper, and they eat supper in silence normally. But this supper, there's somehow a special occasion. There's something that they're going to do that is special, perhaps to mark this commitment that they've made, and to sort of strengthen that commitment. And one of them distributes wine. And they don't have wine normally. And then what he does is there's this tape recorder, this cassette recorder, this machine in the corner on the shelf of the room that they're having supper in. They're all gathered round. And rather to the surprise of the head monk, he comes and he puts a cassette into the machine and plays it, presses play, and it's Tchaikovsky. And it's Tchaikovsky, and it's music from Swan Lake. It's the music of the dying swan. And they pour this wine, and in silence, they listen to this music, this beautiful, tragic music. And it's as if the music and the wine and the occasion of sitting together after this commitment, everything sort of comes to a crescendo. And there's a release. There's an emotional release. And the camera just stays in close-up, in turn, with each face. And it just goes round each old and young man's face. And there's joy. And there's wonder. And there's sort of exhilaration in those faces. They literally sort of light up. And then there's also tears. And there's sobriety and contemplation of impermanence and death and the fact that they don't know what's going to happen. They don't know how long they've got to live. And it's this beautiful, one of the most magical things I think I've seen in film. And it's somehow contextualised by all the sort of spareness of the film that's gone before. Suddenly there's this incredibly lush, romantic music that presumably they didn't permit themselves normally. And then there's this wine. And then Yeah, there's this emotion. There's this emotion. So when metta comes into contact, when we've made a commitment, when we're living from positive emotion, and we come into contact with beauty, or with an ideal of truth or goodness that's higher than us, then it turns into something else. It flowers into Shraddha. It flowers into faith and devotion. And at their own level, in their own way, that's what happens in this film. You see that happen. Faith, Bhante says, is the response, even the emotional response, of what is ultimate in us to what is ultimate in the universe. Faith is the response, even the emotional response, of what is ultimate in us to what is ultimate in the universe. Shraddha is the prefiguration of wisdom. So when we're in touch with Shraddha, to whatever degree we're in touch with Shraddha, we're in touch with the same taste of that wisdom has. Wisdom goes beyond Shraddha, but it is of the same nature. Actually, when we're in touch with metta, we're in touch with the same taste that wisdom has. But in a certain sense, metta without wisdom isn't enough. Metta without wisdom isn't enough. I was fortunate enough to study with Bhante a few years ago, and we were studying, we were talking about metta in the study, and he said, well, lots of people are kind in the world. Lots of people are naturally kind in the world. Metta isn't a Buddhist, you know, we don't have a monopoly on kindness, do we? What makes our practice of metta distinctively Buddhist is that it should be that it's imbued with the insight of an Atman, of self, of insubstantiality, of the insubstantiality of self. I haven't got time to go into what that means if you're not already familiar with that. But metta imbued with the insight that we're not separate and we're not fixed is what makes Buddhist kindness distinctively Buddhist. So to whatever degree we can have that knowledge, that awareness, that insight, to that degree our metta is transformed. On the surface it might look the same as an ordinary act of kindness performed by somebody who doesn't hold those views, but it comes from a different place. It comes from a different place. Ultimately, it comes from a place where the boundaries between self and other have broken down, have dissolved completely, where there is no more self-cherishing because there is no more sense of self. And then metta is a spontaneous outpouring. So it's not something that we have to try and do as I have to normally try and do. In the Majjhima Nikaya, there's a sutta that I came across where there's a man talking to Ananda. The Buddha doesn't seem to appear in the sutta. There's a man talking to Ananda. He's the man from Atta Kanagara. And he says to Ananda, teach me how I can be rid of all the taints, how in a way I can reach enlightenment, to paraphrase it, how I can be free of all the taints of self-clinging. And Ananda goes through various teachings, Dharma teachings, that are said to lead to full and perfect enlightenment. And one of those teachings is, he says, you fill your heart with kindness, with metta, and you direct that metta to all quarters of the world. So your heart, your consciousness, your mind is completely imbued with metta, with kindness, for all beings. Just as we do in the fifth stage of the Metta Bhavana, just as we try and do in the fifth stage of the Metta Bhavana. But then what he says is that you reflect that that metta is volitionally and conditionally produced, and all volitional and conditional things are impermanent and insubstantial. And if you reflect on that deeply enough, he says you will gain enlightenment. And then he says if you fail to gain enlightenment, because you haven't managed to let the reflection go deep enough, then you will gain non-returning. Non-returning. So you'll get pretty close to enlightenment. I just find that fantastic. because my metta bhavana, I kind of think, oh, it's a basic practice. It's something that won't get me all the way. But metta bhavana, as we do it, combined with right view, is it, can be it, could be it. So I find that quite exciting. This flow from metta to joy to freedom and energy is the constant experience of the bodhisattva. The bodhisattva's wisdom, in the fullest sense, therefore, includes metta. Bhante goes on to say that in a sense, you could say metta is prajna, metta is wisdom. But if it is, then he means metta in this exalted sense of imbued with insight. But then I was thinking, even wisdom isn't the end. Even wisdom isn't quite enough, because wisdom needs to be expressed. To whatever degree we're in touch with wisdom, we'll feel a compulsion to live from it, to act from it. Otherwise, it's not really wisdom. So wisdom expresses itself in the world, in action, through activity, through compassion. That is the action of wisdom, and through dana. But when it's wisdom that is acting from generosity, when dana is imbued with wisdom, it's dana paramita, the perfection of dana. And perhaps dana paramita is where we should be aiming our practice, I say that I was on a retreat last year in the summer. I was co-leading this retreat, and I started to have doubts about what I was doing in terms of teaching. We were trying to teach, myself and Maitreya Bandhu, were trying to teach a sort of insight perspective in meditation. And I started to think, what are you doing, Yanavacha? A, you don't know what you're talking about deeply enough, and you're not able to communicate very well, and these people aren't going to get it anyway. And shouldn't you just stick to the level that you're on, as it were, and stick to teaching what you can be sure of? And I really felt this quite strongly. And I in one meditation, I was doing my sadhana, where I was visualizing the Bodhisattva Matridosha, who is the Bodhisattva of wisdom. And, I prayed to him for wisdom. And I prayed to him and said, look, should I just stop teaching meditation for now, until I've sorted out what's going on for me? Should I just stop? And it was a real heartfelt sort of urge. It wasn't an intellectual kind of thing. And that night I had a dream. And I had a dream in Gujarati, which is my mother tongue. But I don't speak Gujarati very well. And I've never as consciously remembered a dream in Gujarati. So I knew in the dream that I was in this special dream. Do you know what I mean? And I was in India. And in the dream, I was having a lie-in, which isn't so special. Which wasn't so special. But I was in some sort of retreat centre or monastery or something. And there were these sort of Indian mattresses, and there was a mattress next to me, and there was a woman lying on the mattress. And I kind of looked at her, and she sort of sat up as I sat up. And again, sometimes in my dreams when I've had women with wild hair, there's been something of a teaching that they've given me. It's like a dharkini appearing. And I kind of knew there was something special about this woman. So I sat up, and then what I noticed was that two little kids, two Indian boys, had already got up in front, before me, and they were starting doing some chores. I think they were sweeping, they were preparing the retreat centre, they were going to make me tea and breakfast and things. And I immediately, in the dream, felt this surge of, kindness towards them, as well as shame that I was having a lie-in while they were having to work. And I sort of remember thinking, they shouldn't have to work, they shouldn't have to do this. Why don't we all have a lie-in? That was sort of my response, rather than perhaps I could get up and help. And I turned to this woman, and said, oh, it's a shame they're having to work. And she said, no, that's dana. That's dana. They're expressing their generosity. She said it in Gujarati. That's dana. And then she said, she looked at me straight in the eye, and she said, dana paramita is the highest paramita. You do know that, don't you? And then I woke up. And for me, that was a teaching, saying, well, I might not be able to teach meditation as well as I'd like. I might not be able to communicate the Dharma as well as I'd like. But it's important to give what we can. Wherever we're at, it's important to give what we can. It's really important to help spread the Dharma in whatever way we can. Dana paramita is the highest paramita. And I want to just turn to Green Tara on the shrine, because Green Tara, this symbol, in a way, she embodies, she personifies much of what I've been talking about. She personifies supreme generosity. Her right hand, which you can't see in this image, her right hand reaches down in the gesture of supreme giving. It is dana paramita that she personifies. Dana that's imbued with transcendental wisdom. She personifies fearlessness, not just courage, but fearlessness. Her left hand is held up, holds a lotus, and her three fingers are upright in this gesture of fearlessness. She bestows fearlessness. She's the quintessence of compassion. Maha Karuna. Maha meaning, again, this wisdom element. Karuna that lives, that unfolds in shunyata. Another word for Karuna is anukampa. Anukampa means to resonate with, to vibrate with. She vibrates with, resonates with, empathizes with all life. And that's the source of her compassion. It's a spontaneous overflowing of compassion. She's the image of the ideal of positive emotion. Not just positive emotion, but of enlightened emotion. Maha Karuna, Maha Maitri, Dana Paramita. This year we'll focus on Green Tara. She'll be our deity at the London Buddhist Centre, presiding over, drawing us up into this ideal of positive emotion. We need to cultivate Shraddha, faith in her and in the ideals that she personifies. She reaches, she has one foot in meditation posture, and her other leg, her right leg, reaches down into the world. She's active. She acts from this positive emotion. It is essential that we feel strongly and deeply about the three jewels, and also about the particular context within which we practice, our Buddhist order, and indeed about the local spiritual community within which we live or work. It comes down to fidelity, staying true to your friends and keeping faith with the Dharma. It is quite significant that in Tibet, the Bodhisattva Tara is known as the Faithful Tara. That's Bhante again. Okay, so I'm going to draw this to a close, but I want to say a few things in summary. So in the Dharma, we have something very, very precious to offer. We have something very, very precious to offer the world around us. And the world around us needs it, urgently. But we can only offer it to the extent that we practice it, to the extent that we embody it. And there are no shortcuts and quick fixes to that. We have to patiently work on our minds, acknowledging and transforming the energy of negative emotions, the energy of this self-cherishing. And we have to support others to do the same. And then through our practice of generosity and the other ethical precepts, we have to strengthen the foundation from which positive emotion can arise. And when we do that together, we create a field of positive emotion that we call Sangha. A field of kindness, of creativity, of friendship, of beauty. And we have to have the courage to act from that positive emotion that we create between us. We have to have the courage to act both within the Sangha, but also to keep reaching out beyond the current bounds of our Sangha, and to try and help alleviate suffering and the causes of suffering wherever we can. And we need to develop confidence. We need to develop Shraddha, that this work is not merely about being a decent citizen. It's not even merely about being a good human being, a decent human being, though these things are important. We need to have the confidence of Shraddha that our true potential lies beyond the merely human, the merely human. We can align ourselves with what is ultimate in the universe, what is embodied in this image, this symbol of the Bodhisattva Tara. And that if we do that with sincerity, with energy, with commitment, with courage, then a dimension that's beyond the self opens up. And it's as if it not only opens up, it's as if it reaches down to us. It responds to us. It even touches us. Tara responds to us. And we can experience for ourselves the freedom and the bliss and the wisdom and the enlightened positive emotion that she personifies. I want to finish by going back to the film of Gods and Men. And at the very end, Christian, the head monk, you hear him read a letter. And it's a letter that's written in case he's captured by terrorists and in case he dies. So he wants this letter to be read in case he disappears and dies. I deliberated whether I was going to read this because the language is very, very Christian. He talks in terms of God, he talks in terms of... he talks in Christian terms. And I thought, well, it's a bit strange to end a Buddhist talk with Amen. And but then I thought, well, actually... The sentiment, the spirit of what he's writing, I can completely, completely resonate with, and I feel very inspired by. He's writing from a spirit which tries to empathise with all life. He's writing from gratitude. He's writing from a refusal to blame. He's writing from forgiveness. He's writing from faith in something higher. He's writing from an idealism that points to self-transcendence and the courage to live and, if necessary, die by those ideals. And he's writing, I'll just read what he says, actually, but... to go back to what's just happened in Moscow, they don't know what's happened, who's caused it, but the report that I read said that it's possibly, probably Islamist terrorism. And, we can have lots of responses to that. I can have lots of responses to that. I can have lots of thoughts about Islam. I'd like to have the sorts of thoughts that Christian writes. Let me just read you this, and I'll end with this. And just bear in mind that, the words come from a different faith, a different tradition. The terms, in a way, aren't really important. There's something beyond all of that. And then I'll finish. Should it ever befall me, and it could happen today, that I should be a victim of the terrorism swallowing up all the foreigners here, I would like my community, my church, my family, to remember my life was given to God and to this country. That the unique master of all life was no stranger to this brutal departure. And that my death is the same as so many other violent ones consigned to the apathy of oblivion. I've lived enough to know I am complicit in the evil that, alas, prevails over the world, and the evil that will smite me blindly. I could never desire such a death. I could never feel gladdened that these people I love be accused randomly of my murder. I know the contempt felt for the people here indiscriminately, and I know how Islam is distorted by a certain Islamism. This country and Islam, for me, are something different. They're a body and a soul. My death, of course, will quickly vindicate those who call me naive or idealistic, but they must know that I will be freed of a burning curiosity and, God willing, will immerse my gaze in the Fathers and contemplate with him his children of Islam as he sees them. This thank you, which encompasses my entire life, includes you, of course, friends of yesterday and today. And you too, friend of the last minute, who knew not what you were doing. Yes, to you as well, I address this thank you and this farewell which you envisaged. May we meet again, happy thieves in paradise, if it pleases God, the Father of us both. Amen. Inshallah. Thank you.